Got my report. My husband is a jolly good sport about all my comings and goings, and all he asks is that I put on my report before I trust. I think I should do that then. I have no idea what time it is, so I don't know if I should say good morning or good afternoon. I was on a plane early this morning, so I think for you it's still good morning. So good morning, everybody. It's very, very nice to be in Palo Alto. It's a little bit warmer than New York and very, very beautiful. And it's always beautiful to see such a wonderful gathering of Jewish women. The only thing, I don't know about my bio, but the only thing that I know that I can say about myself with some certainty is that I'm a very big proponent of Jewish women. I believe in Jewish women, in their abilities, and their energies, and what they can accomplish both individually and for the Jewish people. So I thought that we would spend a little bit of time to get today exploring some different ideas, and I hope that they'll be thought-provoking. I hope that they'll be practical. So I remember, and I know that I'm dating myself, but I'm really an old bubby, so it's fine. I remember the first man, Neil Armstrong, that walked on the moon. I remember the excitement. I remember those words. Some of you are nodding. I remember, you know, one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. It was really a thrilling time. There was a feeling that we're going to explore new frontiers, and maybe in those new frontiers, there will be answers to life's questions. Maybe we'll learn about the origins of the universe. Maybe we'll discover things that will be beneficial to people and to things in this world. Well, since that time, the thrill's worn off a little bit, and the funding's run out a little bit. And even though we've probed further into our galaxy, further into outer space, we haven't, as of yet, come up with solutions to life's problems from our exploration. So I thought that for the short time that we have here together today, we would take a different type of a journey. An exploration, a lot less expensive, hopefully equally exciting, and that's a journey into inner space rather than outer space. And hopefully, we will come away with at least a few clues of a direction that we could take that might, in fact, help us with some of those challenges that all of us face in our life. We, as Jewish people, are called, have traditionally been called, before, long before any of the categories that divide. But one category that unites is the category called Am HaSefer. We are called the people of the book. Why is it that we are called the people of the book? So I assume that the original reference was to the five books of Moses, and the books that, they didn't start out as books, started out oral, but the books that later, that the Talmud became. But really, Jewish people are intrigued with knowledge. Jewish people are at the forefront of every different arena in which human beings seek to probe and explore the world around them. And we value that. We value our ability to explore and to try and understand. We value being well informed. The question that I want to pose to you today is the following question. How valuable is the exploration of self? How important is it that that we understand our very essence, who we are, what our makeup is, in the spectrum of all the things that human beings investigate. So some aspects of exploration of self are self-evident. Just share a few cute stories. So in order to know how our bodies work, we can all understand the value in that. We need to be in sync with our body's rhythms, with the color and texture of our skin, with our body's digestion, with its secretions, with all the things. Why? Because if something goes a little off, we want not too much time to pass before we notice. I'll share a little bit about myself. I actually grew up as the daughter of two Holocaust survivors. My parents, my father unfortunately is no longer alive, my mother, thank God, is very alive and well and beautiful. They were the sole survivors of their families. There was nobody, absolutely nobody. They met in New York a few years after the war at a mutual relative's wedding. They looked at each other, something clicked. 10 days later, they were engaged. They made their own wedding. There was no one to make it for them. And they had a beautiful family, and I'm the oldest child of that family. But when I grew up, we understood that we only had each other, that there really was not anyone else. My parents never took a vacation, never left us alone until I was 15. That was the first time, because there was no one to leave us with. I will never forget one night at dinner. My mother was one of those traditional wives that set the table for dinner every night. My father leaned over and looked at my mother. And he said, "I think there's something on your eyelid." And she said, "No, there's nothing." And he said, "Yes, there's something." And as a result, he insisted that she go to the doctor. And they caught something that could have been very, very bad. When it was just a speck, but only somebody that had only one other person's face to look into for so many years would have noticed. She didn't notice. Her children didn't notice. So physically, it's important. You know, if you suffer from migraines, you feel that aura coming on. You could preempt. You could take steps. And even knowledge of self in terms of our psychological makeup, our psyche. So we need to know our triggers, if we're prone to anxiety, if we're prone to depression. We need to understand the process of psychological denial, because sometimes we have issues that are causing harm to us, to our families. And we need to get with the program so we could get some help. I think all this is self-evident, and you didn't need me to come to Palo Alto from New York to talk about these things. But the question really is, what about spiritual awareness? What's the value in it? Is there value in it? Is it just something like hocus pocus, voodoo, stories from the other side, end of life experiences? Is there value to our everyday life, to the kind of people that we want to become in this day and age, living in America with so many opportunities open to us? Is there value in that spiritual exploration? So let me just share with you a few different things. First of all, in Judaism, knowledge is key. As we said, we value that. But the knowledge is not simply to prevent problems. The knowledge is for the purpose of understanding our tools. There's a teaching, it's actually a Hasidic teaching, but I happen to love to share it, and I'll just share it very quickly with you. I learned it originally in the name of the Baal Shem Tov, who was the first Hasidic master. And he said the following: a person who is unaware of their own weaknesses is like a carpenter who wants to build a table, and he doesn't recognize the weakest part of the wood. Maybe he'll build the weakest part of the wood into the leg of the table, and the table won't be viable. So it's not good. But the Baal Shem says, much worse than that is a person who doesn't recognize their own strengths. That's like that same carpenter who wants to build a table and doesn't even recognize his own tools. If you don't know your tools, what can you build? And as people, if we don't recognize our own tools, our own strengths, then what, in fact, can we build? I'm going to share a story. I lived many years ago with my family. Didn't always live in New York. I lived in Dallas, Texas. And my oldest child was in the third grade. And they had a program in school called Challenge. And Challenge was a program for gifted children. The children were pulled out of class about three times a week. They were given a special teacher in a special room with special resources. And they were challenged to perform, to create. And this was supposed to be exciting, fun, a privilege. Imagine my surprise at the end of the year when my little third grade son came to me and said, Ima, which means mommy in Hebrew, Ima, did I do good enough in school this year? So I said, yes, sweetheart, you did wonderfully. I'm so proud of you. So he said, so do I have to go back to the remedial program next year? If we don't know that it's a strength, we can perceive something that's a strength as being a weakness. We won't use it properly. We won't enjoy it. And so that's a little bit what we're going to look for today. I would say that probably most of the people in the room, I don't like to generalize, it's not fair, and usually not accurate. I would say that most of the people, probably, would agree to the assumption that as human beings, as people, we are some kind of a synthesis of a body and a soul. Certainly, if we go back to our sources, and everything that I talk about, I always make it source-based. That's our proof of authenticity. It always has to go back to the sources, always has to be black on white, always has to be verifiable. So if we go back to the sources, and we look at the narrative of the creation of human beings, so we see very clearly that there's two aspects of the creation. God takes dust from the earth, the elements, to form that first being that was the first human. And then he breathes into his nostrils, Nishmat Chayim, a living soul. Not just life, but a soul that's alive. So we're a body and a soul. What's the relationship between those two things? What does it make a difference to me in my life? I have obligations. I have aspirations. I have ambitions. I have things I want to do. Where does this fit in? Why is it important to me? So it would seem logical that if we are body and soul, that just as the body needs to be cared for, and we're so highly aware of that, and needs the proper nutrition and the proper environment in which to thrive, so it would seem logical that it's possible that the soul needs to be nurtured as well and needs its food and its environment in order to be healthy and to be strong. I hope you all have the sheets in front of you. I'm going to, as we go, hope everybody has a sheet, refer to the handout. When I know who I am, and I know the relationship between body and soul, I know myself better, I know what my essence is, and I know what I have to bring to a relationship. Because in the end, we're going to talk about this in the second part, all we do really bring to a relationship is who we are in our essence. So number one on your sheet, who am I really? Am I a body with a soul or a soul dressed in a body? So how do we usually think about ourselves if we think about this at all? Do we think about ourselves, well, I'm me. I don't know what that me is. That's that me that is so much me that I can't really transfer it to anybody. I can't really describe it to anybody. Even the people that are closest to me in the world really don't know all the aspects of me that make me me. Who is that? What is that? Is it my body? And then my soul is just some aspect of me, my heart, my mind, some halo around my head like the Hallmark cards have. What is it? Or perhaps am I in fact a soul that as long as my soul is living in this world of action, this world of doing, this world of becoming, perhaps I'm really a soul that's actually dressed in a body. Perhaps my body is just the garment for who I really am. We'll see. And we'll see what difference it makes how we perceive it. Let's go to number two. I like to learn sources, so we're going to learn together a Mishnah. A Mishnah is part of the Talmud. The Talmud is made up of the Mishnah, which is the outline, and the Gemara, which is the discussion on the outline. And one of the tractates of the Mishnah is the one that's probably most familiar to people, and that's called, it has a name, it's called Ethics of the Fathers, and in fact, it deals with ethics. So this, in fact, is a very famous Mishnah from Ethics of the Fathers. Let's learn it together. Okay, I didn't bring the Hebrew. I'll say it for those of you who know the Hebrew, but I put the English on the sheet. Maybe you'll recognize it. In Hebrew, I just broke it's one sentence. I broke it down into three sections. That's the A, B, and C. So the first part of it is, Im ein ani li, mi li. If I am not for myself, then who will be? The second part is, Uchsha ani la atzmi, ma ani. But if I am only for myself, then ma'ani, what am I? And then the third part, which doesn't seem to go with part one and two, says, v'im lo achshav, and if not now, ematai, then when? I want to share with you a very beautiful and meaningful and insightful explanation of this Mishnah. Im ein ani li mi li. Im ein, if there is not, ani. Ani means I. If there is no I, if I do not know really who I am in my essence, in my essential self, then mi li, who else is going to bother to get to know me on that level? I, ani, am unique. Therefore, I have a unique contribution to make. If I am not aware, like we said before, of my strengths and my tools, therefore, how will I build what I need to build? How will I create what I need to create? How will I become what I was put here to become? Who will take my place? No one. Because no one else can. And the second part of the Mishnah, Uchsha ani la atzmi, ma'ani, but if I am but for myself, then ma'ani, then what am I? If I think, Uchsha ani, when I think, la atzmi, when I think of myself as just being me, my definition of self is limited. The word etzmi means myself, but it's from the same word as the word etzem, which means our bone, our physicality. When my perception of myself is limited to my physical body, then what am I? Ma'ani, what am I? I'm just a speck of dust, a blip on the cosmic screen that comes and goes without a trace. The imlo achshav, and if not now, ematai, this is C, then when? If we don't realize the preciousness of each moment, then I will lose opportunities to take each moment, actualize the potential of that moment, make a good choice in that moment, and by making a good choice in that moment, turn that moment into eternity. The more that I realize that my soul or I was put here for a purpose, the more each moment of life can be experienced more deeply, can be invested with meaning. You know, it has been said that every person, we all live on the same planet, but we do not all live on the same plane. I'm going to share with you a story. I verified this story. I'm not exaggerating this story. And in my life, this story has, in very many ways, come full circle. I have a son that paints. He's actually an engineer, studying engineering, but on the side he paints. He was a beloved rabbi in the extended community where I live, who passed away. His name was Rabbi Avitan. I once spoke in his shul. I remember him well. And after he passed away, the people, the congregation, some members of the congregation actually asked my son to paint a portrait of Rabbi Avitan from a picture. He was very beloved. I have some friends who pray in his synagogue. And this story that I'm going to share with you now happened during the week of mourning, during the week that they were sitting Shiva for Rabbi Avitan. Rabbi Avitan passed away of heart trouble. During the week of Shiva, his cardiologist, in fact his cardiac surgeon, came to pay a visit, to pay his respects to the family. The cardiac surgeon was a Lebanese man. He was clearly not from the community, so when he came in and he sat down to pay his respects to the family, there were many other people in the room, as you could well understand, it got quiet, and everyone looked to this Lebanese doctor to find out why did he come. So he cleared his throat, he saw that everybody was waiting for him to speak, and this is what he said. He said, you know, I'm one of these people that my whole life I wanted to be a doctor. I knew that was my calling from the time I was a young man. And I went to medical school and I studied cardiology and then I became a cardiac surgeon. And I was really a person that felt that my life had meaning, my life had direction. I have one brother in the world that I was extremely close to, and he became ill with cardiac disease. And no matter what I did for him, I used all my experience and my expertise and my connections to doctors and hospitals to try and save his life, and I couldn't save his life. And my only brother, who I was so close to, left this world. And the doctor continues, I went into a tailspin. To the point that I was in such a state of despair that I decided that I was going to leave my medical practice. Because I said to myself, what's it all worth? All the years of education and experience and everything that I've invested. If I couldn't even save my own brother. And he commented, you know, I'm quite a professional doctor. I was Rabbi Avitan's doctor. And I never speak to my patients about my personal life. But while I was going through this, Rabbi Avitan came to visit me. And he comes in, I'm about to examine him, and he looks at me and he says, okay, what's the matter, doc? So I don't know why, the doctor said, but I shared with Rabbi Avitan my whole saga and how I was just getting ready to shut it all down, leave medicine, go on to something else. So Rabbi Avitan looked at me and he said to me, I have a question for you, doctor. What is the most important time? And the doctor said, I don't know. And Rabbi Avitan said, the most important time is right now. And I have another question for you, Doc. Who's the most important person? And the doctor looked at him and said, I don't know. And Rabbi Avitan said, well, the most important person is the person sitting in front of you at this moment. And then Rabbi Avitan said, and I have one more question for you, Doc. What's the most important thing? And the doctor said, I'm not quite sure. And Rabbi Avitan said, the most important thing is the best that you can do for the person sitting in front of you at this moment. And the doctor told Mrs. Avitan and his children, the doctor's and Rabbi's children, and everyone that was gathered, I don't know what that man told me, but it penetrated. It went into a deep place inside of me. It cut through my despair. And I recommitted myself to my practice of medicine with one difference. Now, when I'm about to operate on a patient, as soon as the patient is asleep in the operating theater, I gather everyone around and I ask them three questions to which they have to know the answer. What is the most important time? Who is the most important person? And what is the most important thing? And you know, time, if you think about it, is really the most elusive thing in the whole world. The past? Whoa, it's gone. The future? It's not yet here. The present? The present? The present? It's elusive. You can't hold on to it. Right? So time is, at the same time, the most elusive thing and also the most precious thing. Because as we mentioned briefly before, a moment in time that is well spent is not lost. Our tradition teaches us that a moment in time well spent is a moment that is actualized, that the spiritual potential becomes spiritual energy that continues to exist in the world, makes you a different person and the world into a different place. So time is elusive and yet the most precious thing. And what about the most important person? You know, people go to the ends of the earth to try and figure out what they were put here for. And it's like those old Hasidic stories where the treasure was just in the backyard. The treasure is close by. The answers are very close by. We need to be able to answer these questions. The most important person is the poor person sitting in front of you at this moment. Maybe you're alone. In that case, the most important person is you. Maybe an opportunity comes your way. Maybe then that becomes the most important person. And then what's the most important thing? Bringing our whole selves, not just our bodies, and not just our minds, but an integrated self, to bear all of our talents and all of our experience, and all of our education, and bringing it all to bear on the situation at hand. Could you imagine how optimally we would be functioning if we could muster most of ourselves in a given situation instead of being distracted and scattered all over the place? When I was talking to my child knew he had 100% of my attention. Could you imagine the difference? And what about a significant other or a spouse, if you were really completely present in the relationship? And what about when you're writing that paper or doing that project for work, if you could really focus and bring everything you are to bear? Whoa, my life would look different. Let's go further. I'm going to skip 4 for now. We're up to 5 on our sheet. So this is very nice, and this helps us to know our purpose. Our purposes are brought to us. We don't have to seek them out. They're a confluence of bringing our own energies to bear on the opportunities that are presented, certainly in terms of spiritual purpose. But there are very practical applications. The body is limited, the soul is not. The body can sometimes execute choices, and sometimes it can't. I caught a cold over the weekend. I drank tea yesterday from the morning till the night. I just drank tea. I said, I have to be well. I have to go to Palo Alto tomorrow. This is not a time to have a cold. This is not a time to get sick. This is just no can do. But you know, colds, and thank God it was only a cold and nothing worse, they don't check in with our secretaries to find out what would be a good time for them to arrive. They come when they come, and they go when they go. So I can make all the plans in the world. And if I would have not been able to move this morning, that would have been a very big problem. So our bodies can sometimes choose, and sometimes they can't execute those choices. But our souls are unbound. They are not fettered by the limitations of our bodies. Therefore, our souls can always choose. And there's 2 points that I want to make about this. And it's really important in any journey of introspection to know this. The first point is actually the point that I just made. That no matter how limited the body or how enslaved from the outside, the soul can never be fettered. My father, may he rest in peace, was from Germany. Because he was from Germany, and that's where the Holocaust started from, he spent the very formative years from when he was 17 till he was 21 in concentration camps. So he told me, he did me actually a favor. He didn't talk about this stuff too much until I was a little bit older. But he told me that the first year that they were in the camps, they knew, they tried to keep a calendar, and they knew when Passover was. So they traded their rations for flour. They mixed the flour with some water. They turned over a metal garbage can. They made a fire in the metal garbage can. And they cooked very rudimentary matzahs on top of the garbage can. The second year, they didn't even know when it was Passover. They didn't know when Pesach was, because that's what it was in that hell. But they wanted to do Passover. They wanted matzah for Pesach. So they approximated. They guessed. They didn't know. And that week, they traded their rations for potato peelings, and that's what they ate. The body was enslaved, but the soul was free, and the soul was flying. And there's another point as well. It's just left my mind. I'll come back to it. Let's go on. Let's look at number... Oh, yes. I remember the point. Sorry. I heard this from a very wise woman. The great thing about being Jewish, one of the great things about being Jewish, is that you know that you're never a finished product. So just as I come to teach, I also go to learn. And I'm constantly studying and working, hopefully, on myself. So I'm going to share this with you. And this is very important to know. The body can't always choose. Sometimes it can and sometimes it can't. The soul can always choose. But one thing that we have to know is that whatever our situation is, And even if it's a situation of our own making, in other words, I messed up. I completely blew it at work. I took an incomplete in the course in school. I blew it with my kids. I said I wasn't going to scream, and I screamed. I said I wasn't going to get angry, and I got angry. And then you're in that bad space of like, how could I have? Why did I do that again? It's important to know one thing, because this too is a thing of the soul, and that is that in every situation that we're in, even if it's a situation of our own making, there's always a choice that we can make, tiny though it may be, that can make the situation better, that can affect us in a positive way, or affect the situation in a positive way. Not magic fixes, not broad sweeping changes, but there's always a step that we can take towards something more positive. Something more positive for ourselves. Something more positive for the situation. Sometimes it's just a weak smile. Sometimes it's just to take somebody's hand. Sometimes it's just to look into somebody's eyes. And as much as it's hard for you to say it, to say I'm sorry. But there's always something that we could do, a choice of the soul. And that's our choice, whether to choose the soul or to choose the body. So, number 6, language skills. We are used to listening to the cues, I'm just reading from the sheet, of our bodies, and to a certain extent, to the cues of our minds. However, we need to familiarize ourselves with the cues of our soul to become more familiar with our own essence. Remember, the body is transient. Nobody gets it. No one escapes that part. In flux, our bodies, the souls completely replace themselves every couple of years. Aging from the moment of birth. Unreliable, I'm starting to feel it at my age. Okay? Subject to harm. I hope that the pilot knew what he was doing this morning when he was flying that plane. Concerned with self. I was really concerned about myself getting to San Francisco this morning. I wasn't as concerned about everybody else getting to San Francisco. And seeking physical pleasure. I had to really decide this morning, did I want another cup of coffee? Maybe like orange juice would be nice. They don't give you so many options today on the planes. But I was just thinking, no, what would I really enjoy at the moment? The soul, on the other hand, is permanent. It predates our bodies and it postdates our bodies. It's constant. It's a chelek eloka mima'al. It's a piece of the divine. It's the most constant thing. It's ageless. It's reliable. You cannot damage your soul. You can damage your body, but you cannot damage your soul. The soul is other-directed. It seeks connections. And it seeks pleasure, but not physical pleasure, spiritual pleasure. I made a little table so that we could come to know ourselves better. It's not an exhaustive table. I've been learning about this stuff for many years. So I just put a table that comes from different sources. So these are cues so that you can listen to your own mind, listen to your own thoughts, listen to your own speech. Watch what you do and know yourself better. Where is it coming from? Is this of the body or is this of the soul? So the body says, I should. And the soul says, you should. What do I mean? You know, I really should go and buy myself that purse, that bag. You know it's like a little pricey, but, you know, I've been working so hard and I really should do that for myself. That's how it comes to me, my mind. I should. You know, you should really call your mother. She's in Florida. Like, you should really call her every single day. You should not let a day go by without calling your mother. But who am I talking to? I'm talking to myself. But it's one step removed. Do you ever have that? Let's take another example. You know, I should really lose some weight. You know, the holidays were great, but I'm still feeling them. Okay? How about, you know, I was speaking to my accountant, and you know, you should really make a separate charity account. That way, you can take 10% right off the top and put it right into a charity account, and then you won't be confused, and you'll know what to do. Who am I speaking to? Me. But how does the thought come to me? As you. Okay? Soros Rabbi Dessler. Okay. Another cue, body versus soul. I have to have it right now. Versus, let me consider. You know, when babies are born, they don't care how tired their mother is. They're only concerned with their physical needs. And when they want their needs met, when do they want them met? Now. Okay? As we develop, at least become socialized, if nothing else, so we learn that in polite company, we have to defer. Okay? But, and there are many instances, I'm not going to take the time because I want to go into other things. But the idea of, let me consider. Let me not seek instant gratification. Let me defer to a loftier cause. I'll put this off so I can... I won't answer the phone now because I'm helping a child with homework. I'm not going to go out with my friends now because I have a paper to finish for school. I'm not going to go to that place that everybody else is going because I don't really belong there. That's, let me consider, the voice of the soul. I'm going to come back to the third one. I'm going to do the fourth and the fifth and the sixth. The body says, this is old hat. And the soul says, this continues to make me happy. Both the body and the soul are pleasure-seeking. They just seek different pleasures. The body seeks physical pleasure, and the soul seeks spiritual pleasure. We are pleasure-seeking beings, no question. So you say, well, what's the difference? Well, there's a big difference, actually. Because all physical pleasures in the world are transient. Even if I go and I buy that bag, it's not even really something that tempts me. But there are other things that probably do. Okay, even if I go and buy that bag, so how long am I going to enjoy it? For a while. And next year? Oh, maybe there'll be another bag next year that will tempt me. Or a pair of shoes, or whatever the thing is. But if even a physical thing fills a spiritual need, then it will continue to give you pleasure. Something that continues to give you pleasure even after the passage of time is something that is rooted in something spiritual. Certainly one of the highlights of my own life was my first child's wedding. It was already many years ago. He's got a whole bunch of kids. But I can just think about that night and I can feel warm and fuzzy all over. Because it wasn't just about a party. It was spiritual to see the next generation of the Jewish people continue. And I'm very much related to that, even at the time. Okay, I like the next one. The body is mind control, and the soul is original thoughts. Have you ever stopped to consider how many of the things that we think, we really think them? Or do we think them because, well, you know, that's what really most people think now. And, you know, this is what is PC today. This is what's politically correct today. And one of the great things about getting older is that you become much less entrenched in that. Because what they believed when I was 30 is completely different than what people believed when I was 40. And now that I'm in my 50s, it's radically different than the last two decades. So they can't all be right. Somewhere along the way, it's not all correct. And maybe none of it is correct. The mind control means the body, just like physical things, seek to join physical things. You put a drop of water on next to some other drops of water on the table, and they will seek to meld with each other. Physical things seek to become one entity. We are souls. Souls are unique. And therefore, the ability to have an original thought is actually something of the soul. And if we had more access to our souls, we would have much more original thoughts. The body is noisy. And the soul is very, very quiet. The Torah was actually given twice. The tablets were given twice. The first time with a lot of noise. And those were the tablets that Moses broke. And the second time it was called the Mamadaka. There was silence, not a bird chirped. And those were the tablets that lasted. I'm going to skip the middle one. I just want to go to the last few points. Very, very important. Okay. Really, the more I go, the more different places I go, the more people that I speak to, I see that women, Jewish women particularly, we have more in common. There's more that unites us than that divides us. And one thing that I think that all people and all women and all Jewish women want is we want really satisfying connections. So we have to seek to bring to the relationships that we have, we have to seek to bring really the inner essence of who we are. Because if our relationships are based on externalities, they will not satisfy us. They will not be joyful. They will not be meaningful. You know, shared experiences is a great thing. But sharing of a self is a greater thing. And if you can have a sharing of two selves based on shared meaning, on spiritual meaning, then that's the greatest connection that you have. About King David, and Yonatan, his great friend Jonathan, the prophet testifies, Nafshi kshura b'nafsho. My soul is bound up in his soul. It's a connection that no time and no circumstance can ever divide. Those are the connections that give us satisfaction and joy and meaning. But we need to get past. We need to get past the externalities. We need to seek to make connections based on more internal things. But we need to take that journey first to understand who we are. What are my essential attributes? Am I truly a kind person? Do I really have integrity when no one is looking? Am I other-directed? Am I reliable? Do I want connections? Or do I seek to disconnect? Am I concerned with myself? Is the pleasure that I seek only physical? It requires a journey of self-awareness. We've spoken a lot about the soul. I'm going to add in, I'm going to go back for just a minute to number four. We skip number four. And number four is actually very, very important. Because if you want to know how to improve your self-esteem or your children's self-esteem, or to help your spouse or friends improve their self-esteem, then the answer is in what we have been speaking about today. When we build self-esteem based on externalities, be they beauty, because that's an externality, even intelligence, even achievements, you know what they ultimately cause? It ultimately causes anxiety. A woman came to me recently, such a talented, together woman, A teacher and a very respected community member and a mother, really an all-purpose woman, all around. And she had crazy anxiety, and we explored it together. And it struck me that her whole identity was tied up in everything that she was doing. She forgot about who she became as a result of all those amazing things that she does. When your identity is tied up in what you do, so I'm getting older, I'm not so beautiful. Yes, I achieved that once, but maybe I'm not going to be able to do it again. Yes, I have this really great job, but what if I lose that great job? How is that going to affect my self-esteem, my identity, my sense of self? But if my identity, and therefore my self-esteem, is more connected to my essential self, to the soul that predates my body and will post-date my body, then I understand that even if I'm not as beautiful as I once was, but I think, I hope, my soul is more beautiful. And that's really who I am. And even if I forget a few more things than I used to, I remember the really, really important things. And one of them is the reason that I was put here for. And if my husband or my boyfriend loses his job, I'm not going to lose all my respect for him, because my connection is going to be based on who he is inside, because I will have developed that in myself, and therefore I will be able to make that connection to somebody else. And then, of course, in terms of our connections, we want that really deep internal connection. So many people come to me. I'm going to share with the last point with you and then tell you two stories and we'll finish. You know, the great thing about soul connections is that they have limitless possibilities. You know, when you really understand who you are and you use that aspect of yourself to connect to others, how many connections can you make? You know, everybody knows this, that one of the representations symbolically in Jewish ritual of a human being is a candle, right? We light a yahrzeit candle to commemorate the passing of a close loved one. Why is it a candle? Because the candle is a very good representation of a person. It's inert matter, whether it's wax or paraffin or whatever the inert matter is, that's attached to a source of energy, which would be the soul. Actually, in Jewish lore, the wick, which is what connects the inert matter with the energy, actually the wick are our mitzvahs. Okay? Those are our commandments and the Torah that we learn that allows the inert matter to be illuminated by the soul. Okay, and that was a little bit number eight. But you know the wonderful thing about a candle? How many candles can you light from one candle? An infinite number of candles. The soul in this world seeks expression. We live in a world where if you speak about soul expression, people look at you like you're primitive, like you're archaic. What are you talking about? I have gone for the last 7 years every semester to speak in Yale University. And I speak about many different things. And one time, I had a few things that they liked me to speak about, and I said, you know, I'm really tired of those things. I want to come and I want to give a class about the potential of the soul. So I come into a group of students in Yale University to speak about the soul, and about 10 minutes in, I absolutely stopped. And I looked at them, and I said, do you think that I'm crazy? And they looked at me, and a very nice young man said to me, you know, we don't think you're crazy, but it's a language that we're not used to hearing. We don't really know where to put it. We as Jewish people were put in this world with a mission. Our mission is to bring the message that we are not just a body, but that we are also in our essence a soul. And if we will access that and live that way, what kind of people will we be? And what kind of a world will the place become? And how connected will we feel to each other? I'll just share with you two stories. First one took place in Israel. There was a old rabbi and his rebbetzin who were going, lived in Jerusalem, and they went to the central bus station in Jerusalem. They wanted to go visit some relatives in the south of Israel in a city called Arad. They'd taken the trip many times before. Arad is a quiet little place, and they always came to the bus station and bought a ticket. It was no big deal. But that day, a hot summer's day, they came to the bus station and they see that the whole central bus station in Jerusalem is swarming with teenagers. Secular Israeli teenagers. Blue hair, green hair, tattoos, piercings, teenagers. Okay? Where were they all going? To Arad. Once a year, there's a rock music festival in Arad, and it seems that the entire bus station was going to Arad. So they quickly go to one of the windows to go buy a ticket, and they're told, you can buy a ticket, but there's no seats left, standing room only. So they had their hearts set, and this old rabbi and his old rebbetzin get on this bus in Jerusalem, and they stand in the front of the bus, and the bus pulls out. Well, about a few minutes into the ride, the two teenagers, and the bus was very loud, and they're thinking like, okay, we hope we're going to make it. The two teenagers that were sitting in the front seat get up, and they offer their seats to the older rabbi and rebbetzin. And they were very thankful, and they smiled, and they said thank you, and they were so appreciative. And the noise was deafening. The music was deafening, but they said, okay, at least we'll get to our destination. When I used to fly with little kids, they used to say, once they close those doors, they're not going to open it to throw us off, right? Okay. about an hour into the trip, all of a sudden, there's a hush in the bus. Something's brewing. One young man stands up from the back of the bus, and he says in Hebrew, L'chvod harav v'harabanit, and to the honor of the rabbi and the rebbetzin. And very quietly, from the back of the bus, a few of the kids start to sing, excuse my voice, Kol ha'olam kulo gesher tzar ma'od, the very whole world, the whole world is a very narrow bridge, a very narrow bridge, a very, very narrow bridge. And the main thing is just not to be afraid. The main thing is not to be afraid. And soon the whole bus was singing. And the rabbi and the rebbetzin were crying. Because under the green hair and the blue hair and the tattoos and the piercings, there was a neshama, a soul, waiting for expression. And I'll share one more story with you. Part of the story I heard and part of the story I experienced myself. I'm sure many of you are familiar with a camp in New York, upstate, called Camp Simcha. Camp Simcha is a project of High Lifeline that runs support services, may none of us ever need them, for children who unfortunately are very, very ill, children who have cancer, and they run a separate program, a separate summer program, for children who are very, have chronic illness and are very physically or otherwise challenged. Several of my children have worked there as counselors over the years. I just went about 6 weeks ago up to Camp Simcha because they do retreats for mothers of sick children. And they bring them and they try and recharge them and reinvigorate them and send them back a little bit more rested and to do the hard jobs that they have to do. So I'll share two stories with you. So the head counselor of the boys' camp, Camp Simcha and Camp Simcha Special, is a very talented young man. His name is Ari Dembritzer. He's a very creative person who's tremendously given over to do whatever he can for these children. Now, Camp Simcha, you know, money can't buy everything, but money did buy Camp Simcha, and it's a fantastically fabulous place. All the vending machines, no money. Okay? Everything you want is there. So, and there's music, and there's dancing all the time. And there's a tradition in Camp Simcha. And what the tradition is that when they have a chumzitz, when the boys and the counselors, the kids and the counselors sit around and sing and tell stories, they sit around in a circle. Some are sitting on the floor, some are sitting on wheelchairs. They take off their shoes. Everybody takes off their shoes. The campers and the counselors, and they throw their shoes into a big pile in the middle of the circle. One day, everybody had thrown off their shoes, and they were singing and singing and singing and telling stories and singing, when all of a sudden there was a loud clank, There was one more pair, but not of shoes, but of iron lead braces, that came into the middle of the room. In this week's Torah portion that we read just yesterday, in the portion of Shemos, the story of our Exodus, God tells Moses, Sal na'alchame al raglecha, take off your shoes from your feet. The taking off of shoes is symbolic, Rabbi Hirsch says, for the breaking down the barriers that confine us, the barriers of the physicality, the barriers of a perspective that doesn't allow us to see who we really are, that doesn't allow us to see our own greatness. The second story happened when I went to the mothers in Camp Simcha. The first time I went, they had a concert. They asked me to stay for the rest of the day. I spoke to the women. I came back moved and humbled. So they had a concert, like this great popular Jewish singer, and he comes all the way up to the mountains, 3 hours north of New York City, to sing for this group of 100 women. Yeah, a third of them are secular women, and a third of them are Hasidic women, and a third is everything in between. And I'm sitting enjoying the concert with the women when one by one I see that the women are getting up and leaving. And I can't understand it. Like, this is like a big guy. People usually like to hear this big singer. And I was enjoying the music. And one by one, the women were leaving. And then I said, you know, I wonder where they're going. And then I realized, in the back of the room, there was a machitza. There was a barrier because it was also the auditorium that they used for the synagogue when camp was on. One by one, the women were going behind the barrier, the secular women and the Hasidic women and everybody in between. And when the last three people, I was one of them, went, what were the women doing there? They were holding hands and they were dancing. And they were dancing like I never saw women dance. And I danced with them like I never danced. Dancing is something of the soul. It's the body lifting up off the earthiness of the ground, over that which pulls us down and limits us. So shoes are a very apt metaphor, and dancing. I leave you ladies with a blessing. Because, not because I'm a person that gives blessings, because when you have such an august group of women together, I'm humbled, and this is how I respond. May each one of you, in your own life, have clarity to understand who you really are as a Jewish woman, and what your great, great strengths are. And no matter what you accomplish in any arena, you have something to contribute in the arena of the soul as well. And this is the best investment. May God guide you carefully, gently, and may we all be together next year in Jerusalem. Thank you.
A beautiful speech about how we need to identify with our souls. Nonetheless, it is time to feed your bodies. So please grab your plates, and in the back of the room you will find our buffet. Please help yourselves and come back to your seats and enjoy lunch.